I'm Jo Fay. You're listening to the Swiss Info programme for September the 6th. From companies making parts for rockets and international research centres looking into the very bare bones of life in our universe, there's plenty of work being done on space in Switzerland. In this week's podcast, we'll hear from the people who designed and built a camera to be sent into space, only to capture what happened in the moments before it'll be completely destroyed as it re-enters the Earth's atmosphere.
This was the challenge, how to compress the data to 98% to get as much of the footage down to Earth with as little bandwidth as available.
Plus, at CERN, they're turning up the power supply. But what's it all for? And how does such a huge project on the outskirts of Geneva make sure the power won't run out while they're in the middle of a groundbreaking discovery? First, though, when the International Space Station was sent supplies in July 2014, an unmanned automated transfer vehicle, an ATV, was used. It took fuel, food, water, and scientific equipment to the astronauts. They then used the so-called space freighter as a giant rubbish bin, and after 6 months it's sent away from the ship and burns up as it re-enters the Earth's atmosphere. The thing is, no one's around to see this happen up close, so Swiss manufacturing and engineering firm Ruag Space were tasked with making a camera to film it. They started work on the project in July 2013, and 1 year later sent the camera off with the ATV on its mission. Ruag project manager Willem Koppels told me how they got started.
ESA asked us to build an infrared camera with which they can film the demise of ATV, that's the automated transfer vehicle, which supplies the ISS. The reason that they wanted to know how ATV demises when it re-enters the Earth atmosphere is to get an idea of how, in general, large items burn up when they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere.
And what kind of brief were you working to? Did they give you very specific requirements?
There was a pretty specific outline. I mean, the mission is fixed. It's a supply of ISS and it re-enters the Earth atmosphere. They simply wanted to film that. So that requirement was pretty firm. And then it started to get more and more complicated. Main reason for the complications were that there's no actual interface between our project and the ATV, the automated transfer vehicle, because of safety reasons. We cannot interfere with the onboard electronics of the ATV. So we need to switch on completely autonomous. This is done by a series of sensors which are included in our project. It comprises of pressure sensors, heat sensors, and accelerometers. So the trickiest part is actually sensing that ATV is decelerating before re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. And with that information, with that deceleration information, it actually switches on our project.
What would you say was really unique about this camera?
It's, I think, the first time that they actually use it for this kind of purpose, actually trying to find out how large space structures burn up while they re-enter the atmosphere. There's more and more emphasis on safety, personal safety for the people back on Earth, and also in the scope of space debris. There's more and more concern about parts floating around in orbit, around the Earth, and things are getting crowded.
Once you have your brief, you have your team together, you know what you need to do, how does the design process work from that point?
You want to get your requirements straight, and fixed would be even a better word, but it's an ongoing process. So you get your designer, you get your lead engineer, you get a system engineer who makes sure that all the different parts work together. And then at a certain point, you have your design, you have your electronics design, and then it goes into the manufacturing.
There must have been some points where you came up against some challenges. How did you deal with those?
The actual camera is the simpler part. The challenges were getting the data, the film, down to Earth. This goes via a Iridium link. It's a very narrow band link, so we can get very little data through. So you get this big gap between the demand, they would like to have a full film, half an hour or something, and this narrow bandwidth where you can actually get only a couple of seconds through if you don't compress the data. And this was the challenge, how to compress the data to I don't know, 98% to get as much of the footage down to Earth with as little bandwidth as available.
So what did you do? How did you manage to make that a reality?
This is where ETH came in. So ETH, Professor Röskin, helped us with developing a software and a hardware for actually compressing this data. I think it's a very unique way of doing it, which hopefully works quite well. I mean, in tests, it's already did.
Once the camera has come back and the footage has been gathered, what kind of things will we see?
If everything works, what we will see is the last 10 seconds. We concentrate on the last 10 seconds, where we will see the inside of the automated transfer vehicle, ATV. We see it heat up. And then hopefully in the last couple of seconds, we see it break up. So you will see parts flying away in the infrared spectrum. You will probably see the plasma coming in with tremendous heat, probably some cool parts again from the atmosphere. So it should be, this is the utmost hope, that it's a very, very action-packed movie in the last few seconds.
So 10-second blockbuster.
Exactly.
Can you just explain to me what are the sort of benefits of being able to see these last 10 seconds? What will that bring to this whole process?
So what we can derive from that would be how ATV actually breaks up, because nobody knows. They know what parts arrive back on Earth. They do follow these things with telescopes from Earth, but close-up footage of how it actually happens is not available. And this, again, is interesting for future missions, how you can actually design for demise, how you can design your spacecraft so that it actually burns up during re-entry.
The ATV is staying at the International Space Station for around 6 months before being sent back to Earth, burning up when it re-enters the atmosphere. The camera project cost around 1 million Swiss francs to make, but RUAG's bread and butter work is building the parts for rockets. Hendrik Thielemann, Deputy Head of Communications, showed me what they're working on.
We manufacture structures for launchers. This is the Vega fairing, for example. It's a fairing for a small European launcher, the Vega. If the rocket has a head, then this would be the helmet. The satellites are inside, and this is to protect the satellites during launch from dust, from noise, from mechanical stress, from the heat, which is caused by friction, from just anything that occurs during the first 3 minutes of flight. We produce some 10, 12 fairings a year for the Ariane launcher, for the Vega, and for the American Atlas V launcher. And this is what people do. I mean, it's a composite structure made out of carbon fiber and aluminum. So there's an aluminum honeycomb core and face sheets of carbon fiber reinforced plastic. And the outside is cork for thermal protection. And it is done on special bonding molds, the different layers by hand. And then it is moved into the autoclave where it is hardened. Then it comes back to the panel machining where it is examined whether everything went correctly. And then the panels are also prepared. They are customized to the respective mission.
Back on solid ground in Switzerland, experiments are taking place to figure out how the very smallest parts of our universe work. The 27-kilometre Large Hadron Collider at CERN, the European Organisation for Nuclear Research, will be operating at much higher beam energy when it restarts in April 2015. To help us understand why and how the power supply to one of the biggest experiments in the world is managed, our in-house space expert Marc-André Miseret from Swissinfo's French department joined me in the studio. I asked him first of all why the power needed to go up.
The LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, which is CERN's current biggest machine, was designed to run at 13 tera electron volts. This means 10 to the power of 12 times the energy of a single electron gaining or losing an electrical potential difference of 1 volt, or if you prefer to make it shorter, 1 followed by 12 zeros. But so far, the LHC has run at 8 tera electron volts only, but it has proved enough to find the highly anticipated Higgs boson, the keystone of standard particle theory. But to go further and find new particles, CERN has to run the machine at its full power. It follows Einstein's famous equation, energy equals mass. The more energy you use, the more mass you will get.
So can you explain in really simple terms what kind of things the physicists will be looking for?
Well, the astrophysicists tell us that the matter we can detect, the matter which stars, planets, but also ourselves are made of, makes up only 5% of the universe. So there's a 90% left, which consists of dark energy and dark matter. To make it short and simple, dark energy would be the thing that tends to accelerate the expansion of the universe, and dark matter is the one that slows down the same expansion. Discovering what these huge amounts of matter are made of would bring us one step forward in the understanding of our world, which is and will always remain the main goal of CERN.
So how is the power supply at CERN managed?
The LHC is made to accelerate hundreds of trillions of protons per second around and around. It uses for this 1,200 giant electromagnets. To achieve superconductivity or zero electrical resistance, these magnets have to work to near absolute zero. And of course, this cooling process requires a lot of electrical power. Altogether, CERN consumes about 1.2 terawatt hours of energy per year. At peak times, it's equal to a third of the power consumption of a city like Geneva. This energy comes through the French National Electric Utility Company, EDF, and CERN is one of its top five consumers.
And what happens if the power is interrupted?
Actually, this happens almost all the time, more than 30 times a year on average, and this can be due to anything from a thunderstorm or a tree falling on a power line or a false instrument reading. In 2011, there were two power cuts of more than 1 hour, but usually these power interruptions last for less than a couple of milliseconds before the system is automatically reset. This affects only the proton beam cycling around the accelerator, but no less critical functions like cooling or ventilation.
And is saving energy something that scientists in this area of work are becoming quite conscious of nowadays?
Of course, CERN is watching its energy consumption closely, looking for ways to improve energy efficiency while still giving the scientists the energy they need for their experiments. Nowadays, most scientists are going green, and CERN, which is funded by public money, feels it has to be respectful of these public budgets in its attitude towards energy. And you know, the public could benefit from CERN's innovations in the field of energy exactly as it already happened with information technology. Remember, the World Wide Web was born at CERN. For instance, now some of its technology for superconductivity is being pursued as a way to distribute power into dense cities to replace traditional power lines.
Thank you to Bill Harvey for his work and research on this topic. To read his full report, head over to our website swissinfo.ch. You'll also find more space-related stories there and details on the camera destined to live fast and burn brightly. Thanks to the technician, Ivan Steiner, and Marc-André Miseret. I'm Jo Fay. Thank you for listening.